Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their spaces into bastions of creativity and wonder, and I've seen students embrace a maker mindset. And so in this podcast, we explore a lot of those topics that I think are really important for us to think about. And today, we're going to talk about something that I think is actually really, really pertinent to this entire conversation. And it's fear. So I'm talking about this idea of student ownership, student-centered learning. I've been blogging about this lately because I have a book on this topic that's coming out, I don't know, in probably the next couple weeks. And the truth is, I'm terrified about this book coming out because it's highly visual. It's different from every other education book I see. And I can't tell if it's good different or bad different. And time will tell. I really have no idea. And this, although it seems like not that big of a deal, was a creative risk. And the truth is, we often have to make creative risks, or take creative risks, I should say, as teachers in this journey toward student-centered learning. So that's what today's topic is going to be about, the five biggest fears that kept me from empowering students. So here's the deal. I want to empower students, but I know that this can be scary for teachers, and I say that because I was terrified of this. But some of the fears I felt as a teacher ended up being, well, not entirely accurate. And that's what I want to dive into. So I recently wrote a blog post about my journey toward empowering students through ownership. There was also a podcast episode connected to this. It began with this kind of throwaway lesson during state testing week. And I had the freedom for the first time ever to do something different. From there, I ultimately embraced this idea of student empowerment and ownership. But I'm going to be honest, I was afraid along the way. I was afraid, you know, what will my principal think? Will I be judged for doing this? What if they fail the test? I couldn't predict where we were going, and that terrified me. What if we didn't hit every single standard? What if things got chaotic? What if kids were off task? What if they talked the whole time? What if it took up too much time? What if they stopped working entirely? What if I couldn't track what they were doing? And the bottom line is this, it felt like a gamble. And it was. But it was totally worth it. Now, I'd like to explore some of the biggest fears. And I know I just listed a bunch, but the fears that I had versus the reality. Because some parts of those fears turned out to be absolutely true. Teaching is a hard, hard job. You feel it at the end of the year. And I get it. Taking these big creative risks are, well, big and creative and, yes, risks. And because of that, it's scary. And when you hear a speaker or a blogger or someone talk about like, well, just do it, just make the leap, just go for it, I think it kind of minimizes the reality that when teachers choose to innovate in their classroom spaces, they are taking a really big risk. And that's something that we should celebrate. That's something we should talk about. That's something, those are the stories that we should be telling at all times. So anyway, here are the fears I experienced. Number one, classroom management might suffer. This was the biggest fear I had. I was terrified that students would turn their freedom into anarchy. Would the emphasis on empowering students lead to misbehavior? Would they challenge the classroom rules and just kind of go crazy? Or would the lack of emphasis on grades mean they simply refuse to get stuff done? I had been in classrooms that felt crazy and chaotic, where teachers said, this is controlled chaos. But for me, it just felt like chaos. It felt scary. And I didn't want that for my own classroom. But I wondered, was this simply a cost of student ownership? Did I have to embrace a chaotic classroom? Well, here's the reality. Classroom management actually turned out to be easier when I emphasized student ownership. Now, don't get me wrong. I had to go over expectations about volume, movement, and safety ahead of time. We negotiated the procedures together with this class-wide procedure grid. I have a video about that if you're ever curious about it. But I failed to anticipate the positive impacts of ownership. Students acted more responsible when I entrusted them with, well, more responsibility. They worked harder and stayed more focused because they cared about the work that they were doing. Now, it was never a utopia. I still had certain students who didn't finish their projects. Students occasionally argued with group members. They got upset when things weren't working. You get the idea. It wasn't perfect. But there was this preventative aspect for misbehavior that came from student ownership. By empowering students to own the learning, they were better able to own their actions. It increased their metacognition. It increased their sense of responsibility. It pushed self-efficacy, all this kind of stuff. And really, I would say in the last couple years of teaching, I often left thinking, oh yeah, I used to have to think about classroom management. Oh yeah, this used to be really hard, but it wasn't really hard anymore. And I would say a major part of why that was the case was students will behave better when they own the learning. Not always, but often. Number two, my second fear, students wouldn't pass the test. I remember being terrified that students would fail our state standardized test if they were working in student-centered, choice-driven environments. It seemed like it wouldn't transfer, you know, going from this collaborative choice creativity to a standardized, irrelevant, solitary, one-size-fits-all test. Those two just didn't seem similar enough for it to work. Now, the reality here is mixed. I would love to tell you just teach above the test. I would love to say that you could ignore the test. I would love to say that if it's always a higher standard of expectations that comes from ownership, you'll be fine. But that wasn't always the case. And I'll tell you why. Often when I empowered students to own the learning, I was able to, quote, teach above the test. I used to use that phrase all the time. Simple areas of student choice paid off on standardized tests all the time. For example, when they got to choose what they read and they were reading for 45 minutes a day silently, they had crazy high reading endurance. And so they were actually outperforming the district in reading, partly because they could just read for a longer amount of time. They knew how to think through hard questions because they'd been asking hard questions. But here's my reality. It didn't always work. Although our class remained at the top 10% of the district average, I had one quarter when my student scores plummeted to the bottom of the district average on our benchmark test. The test simply didn't fit what we had learned. This is why I'm sympathetic, really sympathetic, to teachers who are scared about the test. I hated being in a high-stakes environment, wondering what might happen if we had another quarter where my students didn't perform well, feeling like the spotlight was on me, wondering what the principal would say if maybe we dropped down for a quarter. I hated that pressure. At the same time, I'm convinced of this. We as educators have to be bold enough to let students own the learning, even if it means facing our fears of low test scores. It's difficult. I don't pretend that it's not. There is no guarantee of success. Yes, there's tons of data to back it up. And my own experience would tell me that like 90% of the time it worked. But that 10% is still really, really scary. Ultimately, it sends a powerful message when we as teachers say, I'm worried about the test scores, but I'm more worried about who you will become if you never get a chance to own the learning. guys, this is our chance to model courage. Students are watching, and they will see the kind of courage that we have. And when that happens, I'm telling you, they never forget you. They will always remember that you were that teacher who just didn't care about the test, who always taught above it, and who always chose to empower students even when you couldn't prove ahead of time that it would increase test scores. And again, I want to be clear, sometimes it does increase test scores. In fact, most of the time it will. But I don't want to mince words. There's no guarantee. This is a creative risk. If you're terrified and you really don't want to make the jump, then don't make the jump. It's your class. It's your decision. Fear number three, we won't cover everything on the curriculum map. I remember looking at the curriculum map and thinking, this is so crowded as it is. If I try to do things like Genius Hour or project-based learning, we'll never get through it all. I didn't have the time or the space to add something new. Now, don't get me wrong. I knew that I could combine some standards and make them part of a project. But what would happen when they chose a topic and never chose the topic from a specific standard? What would I do if they chose a strategy that they found to be relevant but never learned one of the skills and strategies that was connected to our other standards? I was worried, too, that students would be working at their own pace and some of them would simply work too slowly and they'd never even get to the standards that they need to master. This fear of pace and time and curriculum map and standards was a really dominant fear for me. But here was the reality. At first, I viewed things like design thinking and project-based learning, inquiry-based learning, student ownership in general, as these kind of additions to the packed curriculum. But then I realized that these were not additions. They were frameworks. They were a new way to organize the content so students could dive deeper into the subject and engage in creative thinking. I realized that student ownership could actually free up time because they spent less time on direct instruction, less time on testing, and honestly, if they mastered a standard, they could move on to something else without having to wait for all the other students in their class to catch up to them. I noticed, too, that many of the standards were content neutral. It's an idea I'll get into later in a future podcast, meaning students could master the standards while choosing their own topics. As they worked through projects, they could practice specific skill-based standards in areas where they needed intervention. So what's going on here is basically students are self-selecting the intervention that they need based upon what they actually need. And they're not spending a ton of extra time on the practicing the standards that they've already mastered. We also layer the standards so that students could work on multiple standards while engaging in one specific task. For example, when students did research, I actually found that about 6 or 7 of the Common Core writing standards were connected to the research that they were doing. Now, this wasn't always easy. It took me a few years to figure out the logistics and design a system where students could kind of self-select skills and topics and standards while they worked on their projects. Sometimes it was hard to balance the individual and group needs at the same time. We still had moments of direct instruction or even, yes, review. We spent time reviewing the standards. But as student ownership increased, we actually felt less rushed compared to the traditional approach I had used before. And even though it seemed looser or even more chaotic, it was actually, not looser. Like more students were actually working the entire time. Fear number four, students won't know what to do if they own their learning. I was really concerned about this, that they just wouldn't know what to do. I knew that if I said, hey class, you can choose the content, the strategies, and the assessment, students would be lost. They would just treat it as a study hall, basically. Students needed some type of structure and system in order for student choice and ownership to work. Although I wanted to empower students, I knew they needed a tool set and a toolbox to own their learning. Now, this reality turned out to be absolutely valid. I made the mistake of trying this like horrible failed Genius Hour project, for example, where they treated the time as, like I said, a study hall instead of using it to pursue passion projects. At that point, I made a few corrections. I did things like designing specific systems for self-assessment and peer assessment. And these are highly structured, but they also include lots of ownership. Using a project-based learning and design thinking framework to structure the creative process, that's another thing I did. And basically, think of it as the framework or the platform that everything else is built on top of. It's sort of like the infrastructure for projects. Another thing I did is modeling how to select skills and standards. And that came a lot through our one-on-one conferences. And that's the last piece, conferencing with students to help them self-reflect and monitor their own progress. I'd also point out that I definitely had them do an onboarding process where we kind of experienced, you know, what does student choice and ownership look like? And I kind of explicitly got into the ideas of choice and ownership. But still, basically, we shifted slowly from less choice to more choice. And I think it's important. We often think of gradual release of responsibility as being something connected to, you know, learning language or learning a specific skill. But I think the same thing is true of choice. Sometimes they need a gradual release of responsibility when it comes to student ownership. One of the things I did was this ownership audit in my classroom every single summer, where I looked at all the systems and I asked, what am I doing for my students that they could do on their own? From there, I worked on designing these self-explanatory systems that students could modify to adjust and fit their needs. Even then, I realized that students sometimes struggled with this student ownership, especially the first couple weeks of school. That's why I created this sort of scope and sequence of how I would introduce additional ownership every week or 2 weeks until they really owned the learning. Like I said, it was a gradual release model. And fear number five, I was worried that my leaders would view student ownership as just me being lazy. What would the principal think if she saw students working individually in pairs and in groups all the time? Would she think I had given them free time? And if so, would she be judging me for it? Would she write me up? I mean, I thought I was going to get written up, which is crazy. Because the truth is, what I was doing was actually differentiating instruction in a way that had never been done before in my class. Would I look ineffective? Would I come across as weak? Now, here's my reality. Most of the principals I worked for really embraced this idea of student ownership. They loved the fact that I embedded intervention and enrichment into lessons. They loved the fact that students were aware of their progress. They were charting their own progress on a regular basis. And if a principal came in and asked a student, hey, what are you working on right now? My students could tell them what standard they were working on and what they were doing to master it. That was kind of a powerful thing for them to experience. Instead of viewing it as chaotic, they saw students who were focused and they valued this sort of differentiated instruction that was going on. For a few things, I had to pitch the idea to my principal. I would say things like, I would like to pilot Genius Hour, and if it doesn't work, I'll scrap it completely. Now, fortunately, I had some of the most forward thinking principles around. They embraced this idea of experimentation. So, the bottom line is this. I was afraid of student ownership, but I was more afraid of what would happen if students never owned their learning. So I decided to take this leap into uncertainty. And this leap wasn't easy. It was terrifying. And I made tons of mistakes along the way. I'm still trying to figure this out. But I've come to believe this. That ultimately, it works. Ultimately, it's all about student ownership. See, the truth is, like I said, I made tons of mistakes along the way. I had moments of crushing self-doubt. I wondered if I was crazy for believing that students could own their learning. I watched students just not finish their projects and I got frustrated. Sometimes I provided too much ownership, sometimes not enough. You get the idea. But I also saw the transformation that happens when students own their learning. I watched them fall in love with learning as they chase their geeky interests and ask hard questions. I saw them embrace a maker mindset, which is why, for all the mistakes I made, I am convinced of this, that there is power in student ownership. And I'm convinced of this not because I was this great teacher, but because I got to see what happened when students owned the process and regularly blew me away with what they were able to accomplish. Again, it was never perfect, but it was amazing. And it was amazing because they owned the process. And that's why I believe in student ownership. Hey, thanks for listening to this podcast. I know it was way more off the cuff, a little bit different, a little less structured, a lot of more ums and uhs, but if you made it through this entire thing, I just want to say thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. And if you enjoy this podcast at all, please leave a review on iTunes. Have a wonderful day and go make something awesome.